Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Having a child to save another can offer a hope to desperate parents fighting against the odds. But the procedure raises emotional, ethical, and, as my guest found out, political issues as well. Joining us in the studio is Laurie Strongen. She's author of Saving Henry, A Mother's Journey. Also here in the studio, Beth Whitehouse. She's author of the book titled The Match, Save Your Siblings, and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls. It's a very emotional story, as you can well imagine. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Laurie.
Good morning to you.
And good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
Laurie, tell us about Henry.
Henry was my firstborn son, born in October of 1995. And my husband, Alan Goldberg, and I went into the hospital that day to give birth, fully expecting to have a healthy, beautiful little baby. We didn't even know it was going to be a boy. And within moments of Henry's birth, the doctors picked up a serious heart defect called tetralogy of Fallot, something we had never heard of before. And they took him and put him into the intensive care nursery to give him a closer look. They ran a battery of tests for a range of other things to make sure everything else was fine, and it was. And they said we were going to wait for one last test result for something so rare that it didn't really merit mentioning at the time. They thought it was unlikely, but they wanted to just rule everything out so we'd know what we were dealing with. 2 weeks later, we got a call from the head of genetics from Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and he told us Henry had a rare, fatal genetic disease called Fanconi anemia, something my husband and I had obviously never heard of, but were unknowingly carriers of and had passed it along to Henry.
And once you received that diagnosis, what went through your mind?
Well, one of we learned a number of things very quickly. I mean, one is that there were only 1,000 cases in the world. It was so rare, which is obviously why we had never heard of it before. And we didn't know anyone who had it. But what we did learn quickly was that it caused a number of birth defects, and in Henry's case, had caused his heart defect. It also leads to bone marrow failure and the need for a bone marrow transplant. In Henry's case, they thought that he would need to have the transplant by the time he was 5 years old. One of the, I mean, if that wasn't frightening enough, and it was plenty frightening, obviously, for a new parent to get that information, but one of the realities was that it, with the type of Fanconi anemia that Henry had, the bone marrow transplant survival rate was really dismal. Yeah. So at that point in time in 1995, nobody had ever survived a transplant without a perfectly matched sibling donor.
And what about the heart defect? What were they saying about that?
They said that the heart defect, tetralogy of Fallot, had a 99% success rate for the repair, but would require open heart surgery. So when Henry was 5 months old, we took him to Boston Children's Hospital, and he underwent open heart surgery, which was completely terrifying. But he obviously survived and did really well with that.
He survived after that very, very serious operation.
Yes, he not only survived, he thrived. I mean, he was, at that point, looked and acted like any other five-month-old child anywhere, and remained healthy and engaged in normal activities up until his bone marrow transplant when he was 4 and a half.
So at that point, he's 5 months old, and you're thinking to yourself, we will do everything we can to help this child survive.
Yes, and you know, as I mentioned, the really only hope for Henry at that point was for us to have another child, which we wanted to do and plan and had planned to do. But the child had to not also have this fatal disease. The child had to be healthy. And there was a 25% chance, because we were carriers of Fanconi anemia, that any child that my husband and I had would also have that same fatal disease. So having another child was actually a scary thing to do.
Of course.
But something that we were determined to do.
Laura is strong, and she's founder and executive director of the Hope for Henry Foundation and author of Saving Henry, A Mother's Journey. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Beth Whitehouse, you've written a book about a very, very expensive and difficult procedure that parents in Laurie's situation have to go through in order to produce another child with an exact match for DNA without disease. Tell me about the families you followed.
I followed a family on Long Island, the Trebbing family, and they had a situation similar to Lori's in that their daughter, which was their second child, was born with a disease, a rare disease called Diamond Black Fan anemia. And they also were told that there were several options, but the only cure would be a bone marrow transplant from an exact match sibling. I started working with them in 2004 when they embarked on their quest, and was able to be in the room with them when their embryos were, when cells were pulled off their embryos for testing, when they were implanted in the mother, the matches, when she went through her pregnancy and birth. And she actually did give birth to a boy, Christopher Trebbing, in 2005, who then was able to give his older sister the bone marrow transplant that she needed.
Have you done research on how often this does happen?
Yes. There have been, at the time that Katie was, that her parents were trying to have a bone marrow transplant, there's between 100 and 200 what are called savior siblings in the world. Now that has mushroomed, and there's more than 250 worldwide. And I just was in contact with Dr. Hughes, who's the doctor who did the original pioneering treatment with Lori to try to save Henry, and who also was the doctor for the family in my book. And he said that he's doing about 4 a week now, and that 1 week this year he actually tested 11 families to try to come up with a matching child who could save the life of a sibling.
Now, the question becomes, are more and more children being born with this kind of rare defect requiring, I mean, I realize the defects are different, but are more and more children coming up with these rare defects requiring a sibling to be brought into the picture?
I don't think it's so much that more children are being born. It's that more parents are finding out about this option. And as more and more people find out about it, which is the purpose of my book, and I'm sure Lori's book is part of the purpose as well, so let people know that you can do this and how it works, then more people are getting in touch with their gynecologists, their obstetricians, they're reaching out to these doctors and are able to do this procedure and cure their children.
Beth Whitehouse, she is a reporter for Newsday, adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She is the author of the book, The Match, Save Your Siblings and One Family's Battle to Deal with, sorry, to Heal Their Daughter. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Laurie, as you thought about this diagnosis that your son Henry had, and you thought about what had to be done to produce a child with who was genetically similar but without the disease process. How did you feel about being the first to go through something like this?
You know, when Henry was born, the only way to have a baby who would be healthy, free of the disease, and also an HLA match to him and therefore able to save his life was luck. And when Henry was 6 months old, we got a call from one of the doctors with whom we had met to try and figure out how we would be able to save Henry's life. And she offered us the opportunity to replace luck with certainty. And the way to do that was through this new experimental procedure called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And the idea was that we would use in vitro fertilization combined with genetic testing prior to pregnancy to know for sure that the baby that we would be pregnant with would be able to live, would not have a fatal disease, and could also, because it was HLA matched to Henry, save his life.
And just to be clear, Henry's birth did not require in vitro fertilization.
Henry's birth did not require in vitro fertilization. And actually, when I got the call introducing the concept of PGD, I was pregnant newly with my second child, who is now a beautiful 13-year-old boy named Jack.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, so I was pregnant. So Alan and I were really determined to grow our family despite Fanconi anemia. And we got pregnant and got very lucky. And Jack was healthy. And then we learned about PGD and decided to embark upon that.
Laurie Strongen and Beth Whitehouse. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're back talking about a new genetic engineering technique that has helped save the lives of children. Laurie Strongen is founder and executive director of the Hope for Henry Foundation and author of Saving Henry, A Mother's Journey. Beth Whitehouse is the author of The Match, Save Your Siblings, and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. And throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet. You can join us on Facebook. Laurie, just before the break, we were talking about being presented with the option of being the first to go through this. But as I understand from reading about it, PGD is difficult, it's painful. Tell us what the mother has to do.
So the mother has to go through in vitro fertilization, much like any other woman who's trying to have a child using assisted reproductive technology. But on the third day after they have extracted the eggs from the mother and united them with the father's sperm, they actually, instead of looking for the most robust embryos to implant into the mother, which would be most likely to produce a pregnancy, they actually extract one or two cells from those embryos. And in our case, we were doing the in vitro fertilization in New York City. The cells were extracted there. And then my husband would get on an airplane and fly them to Dr. Mark Hughes, who had a lab in Michigan, where he would have 48 hours basically to test the limits of science and test those individual cells for the presence of Fanconi anemia and also for HLA match to Henry, which would make them a compatible bone marrow donor. Within 48 hours, he would make a phone call. My husband would have already flown back to New York to join me, and he would make a phone call to the lab at Cornell's IVF Center, where our embryos were still growing, and tell them which of the embryos tested were healthy and a match to Henry. And those would be the candidates that they would implant. But you have to remember, this was the first time this had ever happened. And the technology was not perfect yet. And there were times, we went through this 9 times over a period of 3 years.
Wow.
Wow.
9 times.
Yeah. And there were times that we did this where we would not get results at all, where the results, they were just unclear. And so there were no embryos to implant. There were other times where the embryos that were HLA matched to Henry also had Fanconi anemia and would produce babies who were born to die. Obviously, that was what we were trying to avoid. And other times still, the embryos that were healthy and HLA matched to Henry were the poorest quality of all of the embryos we created. So there were the statistics were so stacked against us in terms of having everything aligned just so that the embryos that were growing that were most robust would also be healthy and HLA matched to Henry. And that did not happen for us. And I think some of what we experienced, I mean, you said, you know, oh, it is painful. I took 353 shots over a course of 3 years. That's a lot. I was, you know, bruised. I was bloated. I was uncomfortable. But anything that I experienced, to me, it was such an honor to be able to have this opportunity to save Henry's life and to give birth to a baby who would survive that I didn't even notice the pain. I just dismissed it because I felt so fortunate to be able to be the first to have this incredible opportunity. And I also felt so grateful for every day that I had with Henry and then with my son, Jack, who had already been born by the time we started this, that, you know, I don't want to say it was comfortable, but it was a privilege.
It was for a purpose, and you understood that purpose. I gather that Jack was one of the 25% who was born disease-free.
Yeah, he was. Actually, there was a 25% chance that each of our babies would have the disease.
Ah,
so
forgive me.
If you're just trying to rule out the disease, you do have a 75% chance of having a healthy baby. And thankfully, he was in that percentage.
Beth, given what Laurie has described, is that typical?
Well, first, things don't always work, and the process has gotten better and better over the years. Laurie had tried this, you know, probably about 10 years ago she started. The family in my book did it about 4 or 5 years ago. So I do have a message for Lori from the family that they owe her a debt of gratitude for going first and for going through this. And they were able to have the happy ending because of the things that the doctors learned along the way. So while it doesn't always work, the percentage of times that it does work has gotten higher. And families that do have the success, you know, in having the children are able to cure their own children.
Talk about Dr. Mark Hughes, who did so much research in this area, Laurie.
I mean, we met Dr. Hughes when Henry and Jack were little babies, when Henry was one and Jack was Jack was actually inside of me still. He hadn't yet been born. And Mark Hughes is among the most ethical, responsible doctors that I've had the good fortune to meet. he is, it's like he was placed on earth to save children. And I think he understands that.
He was at NIH.
When we met him, he was employed by NIH, and he was also employed by Georgetown University Hospital, doing single-cell diagnostic work. But because there was a prohibition against federal funding for research involving embryos, or research that could result in the destruction of embryos, actually, he had set up a lab at Suburban Hospital in Maryland, nearby NIH, that was privately funded.
Does not get federal funding.
And he was preparing for our case with PGD at Suburban Hospital. So he had made it very clear to us when we first started talking that this work was outside of the work that he did at NIH and was done with on his private time with private funds.
But he was forced to resign from NIH.
I mean, he happened, this was back in the mid-90s, and politics was really interfering with science at that time. And he was really caught up in that firestorm, tragically. And he was forced to resign from NIH, and he actually lost all of the work that he had been doing at Suburban Hospital on our case. So we lost precious time.
And why did he lose all that work that he had done at Suburban?
Because he was forced to shut the lab down, and he ended up having to leave Washington, and he relocated to a lab in Michigan, where he was employed at a place that only received private funds exclusively.
He was so discouraged, he almost left medicine.
Right. But he has made this his life work, his trying to determine what diseases embryos have. This technology that is used to create a savior sibling can be used to examine all kinds of other genetic material as well. It's used by families who have a disease in their family that they want to try to eliminate in the next generation. It can be now used also to select gender voluntarily, which is not something that doctors want to have happen, but some doctors are doing that. It can be used for a lot of different things. Dr. Hughes is very devoted to using it to eliminate disease and to do things like creating savior siblings. This technology, however, you know, you might think, oh, you don't need to read these books because you don't have a child who has a disease that needs to be cured by a bone marrow transplant. But in my book has a comprehensive look at the savior sibling issue. It talks to all of the people who have been involved in the issue, from the Ayala family to the Nash family, which the Nashes were trying to have a child at the same time as the Strongens, and they were ultimately successful, and they have the first child documented to be a savior sibling who was born in 2000. It talks to, all the doctors involved in the research and in the ethics. And Dr. David Adamson, who's a former president of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, says that this is a technology that's going to redefine healthcare, and it's going to determine how babies are born.
However, there are some ethical issues that people have raised about this process. For example, how much risk do you expose a healthy child to in order to save a sick child?
When I talk about this, my book, to people, they immediately say, oh, isn't that my sister's keeper? And that is the same concept of what Jodi Picoult wrote about in her best-selling novel in 2004, which then became made into a movie in 2009. But she says, and I interviewed her in the book as well, that she had to ratchet up the stakes. She had to create a situation where a child was called upon multiple times and eventually asked to give a kidney in order to help the sibling. That's not a realistic situation or a common situation. The oldest child born after PGD to be a savior sibling is only 9 years old right now. So this was a teenager in her book, and it was a contrived situation to explore the worst case scenario.
Now, tell me what questions like that went through your mind, Laurie.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I'd like to clarify is the idea was upon birth, the doctors would take the stem cells from the umbilical cord blood, which is typically thrown away as medical waste. So there is no additional procedure done to the baby beyond the actual process of being born. Okay, so the stem cells for transplant comes from the umbilical cord, which is then discarded as medical waste. So rightfully, people are concerned when they hear about these stories about having babies for spare parts. That is not what we were intending to do. I mean, the idea was you take the stem cells from the cord blood and you use those for transplant. No harm to the child. And in fact, this child who had this high chance of having a fatal disease is born healthy.
That's, however, not always what happens. And the family in my book also had the intention of using only the umbilical cord. But when their daughter went for her bone marrow transplant, the doctors decided that the cord blood would not be as effective as taking the actual bone marrow from Christopher, the baby. So when he was 1 year old, they actually took him into the operating room under general anesthesia, and they took bone marrow from his hips repeatedly with the needles, and then put that into Katie. So while the theory is that you use the umbilical cord, sometimes they do have to go into the child, and then you do have to think about what kind of risk you take. And the risk to Christopher in that situation was basically any kind of risk that you'd have from anesthesia when you go through surgery, as well as post-procedure infection. So he was fine after, you know, a couple hours after the procedure, he was running around the hospital. But there are times when you have to do more than just use the umbilical cord.
Beth Whitehouse, she's the author of The Match, Save Your Siblings, and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. What about, though, the emotional, mental health of that child who has been the donor? Right. Sometime down the road.
Well, again, that is speculation, and I have several chapters in my book that deal with the ethical issues of the Save Your Sibling. There is no monitoring. There's no regulation in this country, no legal oversight or any kind of collection of data about the children who are born in this manner. So nobody really knows. And again, the oldest child is only 9, so there's really no one to ask. I did interview Marissa Ayala in my, or talk to her sister Anissa, who was saved by Marissa. In 1990, their family declared publicly that they were going to try to conceive a child to be a bone marrow match. They did not have the PGD technology, so they just did it naturally and hoped that they would hit the odds, and they did. And Anissa's sister, Marissa, is now 20, and she says that when she was in 7th grade, her friends were Googling themselves, and so she Googled herself, and for everyone else, nothing came up. And for her, this big list of articles came up because, of course, people wrote about her.
Yes, of course.
And she read about all the criticism and the people who said, oh, your parents aren't going to love you. And she said, my family loves me so much, I don't believe this. And I see Christopher, he is 4 years old now. He's going to be 5 next month and start kindergarten. And he talks about, he'll say, I gave Katie my blood. I got needles in my back. I don't think he really understands the whole thing, but I think he senses that he did something remarkable, that everyone's proud of him, almost, that he was almost heroic, and that his bond with Katie is very strong. And she'll say, he saved my life. She's 7 years old now. So they do, you know, I don't know what the psychological ramifications are, but the family feels they can handle it.
Laurie, how long did Henry live? What kinds of treatments did he have to undergo?
So Henry lived for a little more than 7 years. You know, as I had mentioned earlier, he had open heart surgery when he was 5 months old, and then his heart was repaired and he had a very normal life. He went to preschool, he played soccer, he ran a great lemonade stand business. I mean, he had a very, very full life. Over the course of our 9 attempts to use PGD, Henry had to get his blood checked every month, and his blood counts were plummeting over those 3 years. By the time he was 4 and a half, he needed to have a bone marrow transplant. And we went out to University of Minnesota Children's Hospital, where Henry was the recipient of bone marrow donated by an anonymous adult donor, a very kind woman who we got to meet later on. Henry's transplant went very well initially, but over the course of 2.5 years, so when he was from 4 and a half to a little more than 7, he had a lot of complications, all of which were related to the fact that he didn't have a compatible enough donor.
I see.
So, you know, he would, you know, he just had, you know, something would happen to his liver and he would end up having to have biopsies and surgical procedures and things would look really grim. And then one day he would wake up and say, like, what are we doing in the hospital? Let's get out of here. Let's go home. And we would, and he would resume school and he would go back to the movies with his friends and life would get back to normal for him and with his brother Jack and then ultimately our third son Joe. And then he would hit another complication. And it was very up and down for 2.5 years. But, you know, when he was just past his 7th birthday, his body, he just, you know, his body started to wear down. It just was too much for him. And tragically, in December of 2002, he died.
Laurie Strongin. Her new book is titled Saving Henry, A Mother's Journey. We'll be back after a short break with your calls and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working with low-income families to claim tax credits and achieve economic stability. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The creator of the HBO series The Wire, David Simon, teamed up with writer Eric Overmyer to create a new HBO series called Tremé. It's set in New Orleans 3 months after Katrina. The show premieres April 11th. On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Simon and Overmyer. Join us.
We've had a number of emails and questions, the same issue. How was the cost of Henry and his mother's care covered? How much did it cost?
The because we were the first to use PGD in this way, Mark Hughes actually did not charge us anything for the genetic testing. What we did have to pay for was the in vitro fertilization, which, for anyone who's gone through it, knows is quite expensive.
Like $11,000
every time. I mean, our costs for this procedure, all nine times, was over $135,000.
And where did that money come from?
Some of it came from savings that my husband and I had, although we didn't have much because we were young. We were in our 30s at the time. So our families helped us tremendously, for which we will forever be grateful.
Gosh. And I can talk about what it does cost today because the Trebbings did have to pay for their in vitro fertilization and PGD because they were not the first. Their treatment, the entire thing, including Katie's bone marrow transplant, topped $325,000.
Wow.
Their insurance company did cover about $250,000 of it, but they had to pay for the rest. They paid over $35,000 out of their own pocket for two cycles of in vitro fertilization and PGD to have Christopher. They paid for medications that weren't covered by insurance, and their families held a fundraiser that helped them a lot.
Really?
About 400 people came and paid $50 a ticket, and they raised money that way.
And just to clarify also, Henry's transplant was millions of dollars. Like, that is not part of that figure that I cited with all of the complications that he had. That was mostly covered by insurance, obviously.
I see. Now, Lori, you have founded this, the Hope for Henry Foundation. Now, tell me about that foundation, what it's doing now.
So one of the things that we found with all of Henry's medical needs is that it was relatively easy to get excellent medical care at hospitals around the country. But what was very difficult was to find resources that tended to the kids' spirits, because after all, just because they're sick doesn't mean that they're not a child who's desirous of having fun and doing the things that kids love to do. So what Hope for Henry does is bring sort of Henry's love of entertainment and fun to other kids with cancer and other life-threatening illnesses who are spending weeks and months and years in the hospital. And we give the kids iPods loaded with music and movies. We give them portable DVD players and movies to watch and digital cameras so that they can exchange pictures with loved ones who might be far away. We throw birthday parties for them in the hospitals. We bring in live superheroes. It's all about bringing smiles and laughter into their lives.
And we do have a photograph of Henry on our website. That's drshow.org. Let's go to the phones, first to Monterey, California. Good morning, Bobby. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Lori. Lori, I know you know our family. I'm the honorary godmother of the Frohnmeyer family. And we had two children, Katie and Kirsten, both of whom were born with Fanconi, and two boys who were not born with it. Again, it's not genetic, obviously, since Henry had it as well. The family then had an additional child, again, before any of the scientific ability to manipulate. And sadly, Amy was born with Fanconi's as well, although she's 22 and now a graduate student at Stanford. What I wanted to say is, Lori, I love the fact that you set up a foundation to help children. We also did, but we went a slightly different way and set up the Fanconi's Anemia Research Fund, which has been raising millions of dollars to help doctors help children with Fanconi's, as well as run a family camp called Camp Sunshine in Maine.
That's absolutely wonderful, Lori.
Yeah, the Frohnmeyers are just the most wonderful family, and thanks to them, there's an organization called the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund, which supports medical research to improve treatments and to ultimately find a cure for Fanconi anemia. And Henry's life, no doubt, was extended because of the important research that this organization has done.
Bobby, I'm glad you called. To Donna in Southeast Florida, good morning. You're on the air. Donna.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
My question is going to go back to your conversation a few moments ago about the ethical side. As I'm listening and I'm fascinated and I'm in awe of some of these parents and what they've done and all they've sacrificed and what they've done to help save their babies, there's just this gnawing question that keeps coming back about the issue of designer children. Where does it end? We've clearly got the beginning. We were already starting. We're doing these things. Genetic research is so hot. It's such a big thing. But at what point are we playing the god? Are we maneuvering and posturing and doing things within cells to create what we want, regardless of what we may think today is morally not correct? Where does it end?
All right, Beth.
I explore this topic in depth, and the question is, how much of a hand do we want to have in this? I just want to clarify that the doctors are not doing anything to change what's in the embryo. They take an embryo and they take a cell off and they test what's already in it. So they're not manipulating, they're not like putting it some kind of value into the embryo or changing its makeup. Whatever the parents have, that's what the embryo has, and they're screening. However, this technology has mushroomed. They can screen now for chromosomal abnormalities. They can screen for all kinds of diseases. And the fear is, now that we can look at what's inside the genetic makeup of an embryo, what else can we find out? There are already families who are using this because they have three sons and they desperately want a daughter. So they're willing to go through in vitro fertilization and PGD and pay all that money, not because they need any kind of health or whatever, but because they wanted a little girl they could dress in pink or a little boy in blue. And there's lots of moms on the internet who call themselves, you know, praying for pink, you know, have blue and talk about their quest. And to them, it's very important. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine has recommended that doctors not do this. In other countries, it's banned. You're not allowed to do it in England. In Australia, there was a five-year moratorium on gender selection for voluntary reasons, and that ban is up this year, so they're redebating the issue again. People are concerned that will we become like China, where in 10 years they're supposed to have 30 million more men than women of marriageable age because they prefer males there. So the question is, how far do we go? And people are afraid that then people will start to test for other traits that have nothing to do with health. Eye color, hair color, whatever we eventually find out on the genetic map is available to test for. And there was one doctor in California who in 2009 advertised on his website that he could help you pick preferred eye color or hair color. And there was a media frenzy, and he was vilified by other doctors. And Dr. Adamson, who was the president of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, did say that he thinks society will rein in these things and will express their displeasure.
Yeah, but I think what I'd like to do is sort of draw a line where using this technology for life or death issues should be acceptable. It just should. When you're talking about the abuse for cosmetic preferences like hair color or eye color, that actually threatens the intended use of this technology and should not be permitted.
But there is the in-between of that. There's also diseases that are now being tested for that are not life-threatening. People are testing for the breast cancer gene to see if you might develop it later in life. In England, there's now a list of 116 things that you can test for.
Where do you see that coming into it? If you're testing for
something
breast
that could
cancer,
make you go blind,
for
or...
example.
Right. I mean, I feel like, you know, in life, all sorts of things happen. Bad things happen to everyone, and you don't know when or under what circumstances they're going to happen. I mean, I just think it's very different to screen out a fatal childhood disease than something that has the potential of developing far later in life.
All right. To Salt Lake City, Stephanie, you're on the air.
Wow. Hi, Diane. I listen to your show every day, and I've never actually taken an opportunity to call you because I've never had anything to say. And I woke up this morning to hearing one of your guests mention Dr. Mark Hughes. And I was just floored because my husband and I had to use Dr. Hughes' services to try to have a baby that would not have a horrible disease that we have in our family. As your guest was talking about the Fanconi's anemia, I believe.
Yes.
For her family had a 25% transmission rate. Well, in our family, we have what's called a dominantly inherited disease, meaning you can look at your family tree and see everybody who's had it, called myotonic muscular dystrophy. And we have what's normally for the disease a 50% transmission rate. In our family, it's closer to 70%.
Hmm.
And so to avoid having this, because I have it, my mother has it, her sister, her father, everybody's had it, to avoid giving that to our next generation, we used Dr. Hughes to try to have a baby. And even though we were not in the end successful, the fact that they were even able to try to provide such a service was wonderful. And I understand exactly what your guest was talking about when she talked about how many shots she had to do and how it didn't matter because she felt that she was doing what was so important for her child in the end. And I'm just very grateful to you for having taken that time to do that so that my husband and I could have had that chance. And I just really appreciate it.
Stephanie, I'm so glad you called. I'm sorry that in your case it was not successful.
Yes, Stephanie, thank you so much. And I want to say that one of the many things for which I'm really grateful to Dr. Hughes was the opportunity to try, because I think it gave us the courage to have another child, which without that technology is very frightening. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Beth, how many people who go through this kind of genetic screening because they're suspicious mm-hmm. or there is some hereditary factor turn to adoption as opposed to going through this?
I think it depends on the person. I know there's a strong human desire to have a biological child.
Of course.
And people often will try this first as much as they can before they turn to the adoption route. And so it's just a human desire.
And does insurance pay for in vitro fertilization because of this kind of concern?
It depends on your insurance. A lot of insurance that cover in vitro fertilization, it's a $10,000 rider. That's it. When that's done, you're done. So this cost, as you see from Lori and from the Trebbings' attempt to have a child for their disease, which is diamond black fan anemia, which incidentally, there's also a foundation raising money for that disease. They have to pay for this, you know, themselves.
Beth Whitehouse, her book is titled The Match. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Palm Beach, Florida. Hi there, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I had the same experience with Dr. Hughes that prior lady just had. My sister had to go through IVF, and we knew about our genetic problems that we have in our family. And I'd asked her to go through the PGD so that we could eliminate it for her children because she knew she was a carrier. So she did go through it the first try. They messed up her eggs, so she had to go through it again. And the second try, her eggs were looked at. Dr. Yu said everything was great with these eggs they implanted in her. And it turns out that of her two twins that were born, one is a carrier and one has the genetic disorder.
So in other words, they made an error?
Yeah, it was a complete error.
Well, that is true that errors occur in every country and every lab that does this, because what you're trying to do is to reduce the chances, but you don't get to zero. It's virtually guaranteed, but it's not guaranteed. And so that's part of the issue that they're trying to still work out, is how to, you know, do it better and how to, you know, make sure it always works. But there are errors, and there are And Dr. Hughes, I know, has told people that there are errors in every lab that does this, and it's horrible. And I feel horrible for your family. And, you know, the diseases, I know they're trying their best. I know that there was an article earlier this year that talked about how some of man's most horrible inherited diseases are diminished, and almost some of them close to being disappearing because of this technology. So that's the hope.
Interesting. Finally, to Detroit, Michigan, Latham, you're on the air.
Yes, Diane. I guess my question is, doesn't this just push the disease down generations? In other words, you just perpetuate it for two or three generations because you don't eliminate the problem. You know, in theory, you will eventually maybe be able to cure it, but initially you're really just moving it down.
How do you figure that if a child has been born without the situation or without the disorder? Why are you saying it's pushing it?
Do they change the genetic makeup of the child?
Beth.
No, they do not change the genetic makeup of the child. What happens is you have two parents who are carriers and they produce embryos and they... Each child gets 23 chromosomes from their father and 23 from their mother. And what they get from their father and their mother, if both are carriers, there's a 1 in 4 chance that the child will have the disease. So what they do is they look for the embryos that do not have it. So you're not, I don't understand what you mean by perpetuating to another generation, because the child that's born would not have the the genetic mutation.
Last question. Are there concerns about the discarded embryos?
I mean, there are lots of concerns about the discarded embryos. And at the last I heard, there are about 500,000 embryos frozen and stored in vitro clinics across the country. And, I mean, in our particular case, we did create more embryos than we were able to use. And we tried to go back and have a third child using frozen embryos that were tested as being healthy. And we were not able to get pregnant that way and ultimately donated those embryos to research so that this could be successful for other families.
Laurie Strongen, her new book is titled Saving Henry, A Mother's Journey. And Beth Whitehouse, her book is The Match, Save Your Siblings, and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.